Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. Menopause does not get enough attention from healthcare professionals. Every organ system in a woman's body is affected by menopause. Their brain health, their heart, lung, kidneys. Experiencing menopause involves so much more than hot flashes. So why are women still being so underserved? Dr. Mary Claire Haver is here to change all of that. She is a board-certified OBGYN, a certified menopause practitioner from the Menopause Society, a certified culinary medicine specialist from Tulane, and a best-selling author with a focus on women's health. Her latest must-read, The New Menopause, discusses everything a woman needs to know during this hormonal transition and beyond, including lifestyle modifications and tools to help you take charge of your health. If you're a woman in menopause, perimenopause, or just want to prepare for these inevitable shifts, this is an episode you don't want to miss. So the title of the book is The New Menopause, which is amazing, and I encourage everyone to buy. Before we jump to the new, let's talk about the old. What's the old menopause versus the new menopause?
You know, when I hearken back to what my own personal views were about menopause before I went through it and what I was trained and taught in my residency, you know, it was a natural process that 100% of women went through, and it was mostly heralded by a few bothersome hot flashes. And what I didn't understand and what really wasn't taught to us was that every organ system in the body is affected by menopause. And when we're not training our healthcare professionals how to like recognize this constellation of symptoms that can be really different in each individual patient, that's where a lot of the gaslighting and dismissal seems to come from, is that there's not recognition of, besides hot flashes, there's mental health changes, there are cognition changes, there are gastrointestinal changes, there are lung, heart, kidneys. Every organ system in the body is affected by estrogen withdrawal and deprivation. And I feel like moving forward, the new menopause is trying to educate women about their entire body and how menopause can affect it so that they can be better advocates for themselves with their healthcare providers and in society in general.
Yes, love that. And, you know, we just had Dr. Lisa Moscone on the show. And I think one of the key takeaways there, you know, menopause just doesn't show up at age 50. The process starts decades before. So if you're a woman in her, you know, late 20s, early 30s, like there are changes starting to happen. And so can we talk about perimenopause? And like walk us through the process. Like let's go decade by decade. If I'm in my, you know, say 30s, 40s, and 50s, like what are the things I should be on the lookout for?
So let's back it way up. Let's go to birth. Okay. So this is where females and males really differ as far as our reproductive organs. Females are born with all of our egg supply, about 2 million eggs. Males are born with gonads that create their genetic material fresh every day once they hit puberty, right? You could potentially father a child, not that you would want to, until the day you die. It'd be tough, but you could, right? And you continue to create sex hormones at fairly normal levels until you die. We're different. Because we're born with all of our egg supply, and that deterioration begins in the womb. You know, by the time we're born 2 million eggs, by the time we hit puberty, like each month we're losing about 11,000 eggs trying to ovulate. And by the time we're 30, we're down to about 10% of our egg supply. And by the time we're 40, we're down to 3%. So perimenopause is when your body recognizes something's different, that it's getting harder and harder to produce those sex hormones, harder and harder to ovulate. The brain sending down those stimulating hormones is having to really rev up that process in order to get the ovulatory process to continue. We start skipping ovulations, things get delayed, periods change, you know, so when the body recognizes those changes. So in our 20s, most of us get away with it. Everything's kind of functioning okay. We have enough eggs in reserve to kind of keep the process going naturally. But somewhere in our 30s, so the average age of menopause is 51 in the U.S. That's for Caucasian women. For women of color, you lose about 2 years on that. Still normal is 45 to 55. perimenopause, when our body begins to notice the changes and we start having functional differences, begins 7 to 10 years before the period stops. So if you just do the simple math, somewhere between 35 and 45, something's not right. And what makes it really more puzzling for healthcare providers who, even if they aren't trained, is that that symptomatology can be very, very different from woman to woman. Where one woman, you know, really hot flashes are really cliche. About 85% of patients will have them, and you can't really blame them on anything else. Maybe tuberculosis, but that's pretty rare, thank God, you know, for us. So really the cliche symptoms are the ones that are not easily blamed on something else. And so usually when women start having increasing depression, anxiety, it's blamed on an underlying mental health disorder. When they start having cognition problems, as you talked with Dr. Moscone, it can get blamed on many other things. Musculoskeletal pain gets blamed on injury. When it's really menopause is the root cause of this declining estrogen levels.
Well, also quality of sleep.
Yes, sleep deprivation is huge.
Let's talk about that one. And the other big one is weight, unwanted weight gain. So let's go to sleep first.
So sleep deprivation can start as difficulty falling asleep, especially if anxiety becomes part of your menopause picture. And, you know, that racing thoughts at night, that inability to turn off your brain. And then when we lose sleep, everything else declines. Our cognitive function, you know, it just kind of adds insult to injury. Or you're sleep going to bed fine, you're getting that 2 a.m., 3 a.m. wake up. And nothing seems to help. You know, you cut back on alcohol, you do all the things, the sleep hygiene, and then you're still not getting good quality sleep.
One point on sleep before I move to weight, how it shows up with my wife, Colleen, is if she gets woken up by usually one of our, you know, little people, the footsteps or a scream or a nightmare or what have you, she can't get back to sleep.
Yeah. So that is something I hear, you know, I have my patient population, of course, because I just do menopause care now, but also I have a lot of followers on social media. So I'm constantly reading the comments and the inability to fall back asleep. A lot of us are struggling with having to get up and go to the bathroom, even if we don't have littles anymore. You know, the incontinence becomes an issue. The bladder irritability is another function of menopause. Getting up to pee at 3 a.m. and then you just can't go back to sleep.
And so weight gain.
So yeah, weight gain. So there's a lot of studies, there's a lot of contradiction on the actual weight gain. So when we look at women traversing time outside of menopause, just all ages, weight gain is a common theme throughout middle age, 1 to 3 pounds a year, depending on the woman. However, what is absolutely related to menopause, which is probably less, really more of a metabolic problem, is where she's gaining weight. So what we see distinctive to estrogen withdrawal is a new onset of what we call ectopic fat or visceral fat. So that intra-abdominal fat, the fat around the liver, the fat around the pericardium, around the heart, that is new and very much related to the menopause transition. And it also represents increasing risk in chronic disease as far as cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension, stroke, et cetera.
So that would speak to the need to go get a DEXA scan, because my understanding, that's kind of the gold standard if you want to understand visceral.
Yeah, there's a few ways to measure visceral fat. MRI is probably the best, but no one's paying for that. So DEXA scans, fortunately, are very, very effective at measuring this. And now, like in our community here in Texas, there are DEXAFIT centers. They're not paying me to say this. So where you can go, and I just paid $99 to go have a DEXA scan because my insurance, and I wanted to know my bone density. And so because I don't want to wait till 65 and be osteoporotic, knowing I'm at risk because of my age and genetics. So I went and paid so I would have more information. Thank God I have the bones of a 30-year-old, according to Dr. Vonda Ray. But I was also able to measure visceral fat. Now, in my clinic, I have an in-body scanner, which uses electrical impedance. It's not as accurate as a DEXA, but it's much less expensive. And I'm able to, you know, kind of guide my patients as far as nutritional recommendations based on visceral fat or no visceral fat.
A lot of gyms have in-body. The gym I go to here in Miami, Anatomy, has an in-body scan. So that one is definitely more accessible. And I think it's directionally accurate.
Right. So if you're looking at trends, which is what I'm doing with my patients, that is, it's not a bad way to go. So as far as absolute measurement, you know, again, DEXA is going to be more accurate. MRI is the best, but it's much more accessible. You're right. Lots of gyms have them and it really guides you as these things are working for me. I'm hanging on to muscle mass. I'm losing visceral fat.
So in terms of action steps, you know, traditionally, and you've been critical of this and rightfully so, there you'd hear a lot, you know, if you want to lose weight, you know, eat less, exercise more, which is terrible advice for women as they age.
It doesn't work.
Yes. Let's talk about that. What action steps? What can women do?
Yeah. So when I looked at the studies, so, you know, calories in, calories out. Calories are important. No one's negating this. We all know if we overeat, we're going to put on fat, you know, if we don't burn it off. But like the mentality that comes with that and the like, we're, you know, the mental beatdown is not helping, at least my patient population. And so fortunately, as far as visceral fat, sure, if I locked you in a cage and starved you, you would lose some visceral fat. You'd also lose muscle mass. Your basal metabolic rate would drop. You know, that's not a healthy way to do anything. When we look at least at women, and that's really the studies I focus on, fiber intake is very important. So at least 25 grams of fiber per day for a woman. Most women are getting about 12 in their diet, you know, because of this complete mindset of calories in, calories out, you know, skinny over strong. If I'm thin, I'm healthy, is really done a disservice to women. I know from myself, being a cardio queen in the 80s and 90s, I probably chipped away at my bone and muscle strength through those decades so that I could be thin and have that social currency without really focusing, not realizing I wasn't really focusing on the things that would keep me healthy as I aged. And so fiber, so let me go back, sorry. So fiber intake is so important. You really should try to get your fiber from food. 25 is minimum. Most of my patients really, you know, after a few months, will push for 35 or more grams of fiber per day. And studies are showing that women who do that consistently have less visceral fat. Now, why does that happen? Fiber does a lot of things. We know that there's soluble and insoluble fiber. Soluble fiber is what feeds the gut microbiome, keeps it healthy. That is their food. That is the prebiotic. And once if your gut microbiome is well-fed and happy, everything's going to work better. Your mental health, your rest, your glucose. It's really, we feel like the biggest thing that turns the needle with fiber is that the gut microbiome is happy and healthy and creating the butyrates, which are anti-inflammatory, being fed into the bloodstream. Also decreasing the rate at which your body absorbs glucose and blood sugar from the gut, therefore lowering your insulin levels. And insulin is one of the main drivers of fat to the intra-abdominal cavity. Just being menopausal, going through the menopause transition, increases your risk of metabolic syndrome, including insulin resistance, by up to 30%. Simply by the loss of estrogen. So we're trying to combat that with nutrition. Number two, watching your added sugars. So, you know, sugar's got such a bad rap in the keto movement. And a lot of people, you know, and in the effort to lose weight, went the keto route and cut all sugars from their diets, including the healthy ones found in fruits and vegetables. And so, and some dairy. And when women limit those added sugars, sugars added in cooking and processing, not fruits and vegetables, limiting those to 25 or less, mostly found in drinks and additives and condiments, and, you know, they do have less visceral fat than others. Diets rich in probiotics, you know, if you can't, you know, one of the best sources in the U.S. at least for probiotics is going to be yogurt and some of the dairy products. But if you can't tolerate that, you can do kimchi, miso, kombucha, you know, lots of things are fermented. So, you know, focus on fermentation or a supplement. Turmeric supplementation, again, turmeric's not essential, but it can be really helpful because it's such a powerful antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and movement. So moving your body every day, what does that look like? I have to meet my patients where they are. If they're on the couch, let's go for a walk. If you're already walking, let's put on a weighted vest. Let's pick up some weights. So, you know, doing resistance training to hang on to that muscle strength, as well as that zone two cardio seems to be really helpful for visceral fat. And things that lower your cortisol, decreasing the stress in your life. And that can look like different things to different people. So I try to have a conversation with my patients around what works for you. You know, I kind of poo-pooed meditation and journaling. I was too type A for that. But, you know, I went through some pretty rough times with my own menopause, having teenage kids, losing my brother, finally kind of threw in the towel, got some counseling, and she taught me about the power of meditation and journaling and gratitude. And that has just changed my life for the better. You know, really gave me the headspace and the power to do, you know, be on this menopause journey and be a warrior for menopause.
So a couple of things to unpack there. And you mentioned, you know, the 90s focusing on cardio and being skinny. And culturally, I think there's been a big shift there. One of the biggest shifts I think we've seen since I've been doing this the last 15 years, where and I think this is a great thing, the focus is now on being strong and the importance of maintaining lean muscle mass as you age. So you mentioned resistance training, and usually what goes hand in hand there is protein. So can we talk about protein and your views there?
Yeah, protein intake. When I wrote, you know, my first book was Galveston Diet, and it was not protein centric. And if I had, I'll probably rewrite it in the next 2 or 3 years. I'm going to do more of a focus on protein intake. The protein needs recommended by the Food and Drug Administration for women are about 0.8 grams per kilogram of lean body mass or your ideal body mass. Most women know what their fighting weight is, you know, when they were the healthiest. You know, I say at age 25, if you were like athletic and running around, like, what did you weigh then? But really, when you look at the WHI study, there's good information that did come out of that study. Unfortunately, not around breast cancer, but, you know, they followed these women for years and looked at frailty and they looked at protein intake. And the women who were sticking to the 0.8 had much higher fragility scores. The women who were double that, 1.6, 1.5, 1.7, were much less likely to be frail, simply looking at protein intake. So now when I'm counseling patients, especially on their body scan, if they're coming in with low muscle mass or osteopenia, because that musculoskeletal unit really does work together, I'm recommending much higher protein intakes. So, and I'm giving them grams per day because I have, you know, I have their basal metabolic rate. I have a lot of information from the body scan that I can do that for them.
Yeah, I think it's super important and one of the biggest shifts we've seen. I think something else that I want to come back to, which is so interesting, you mentioned, you know, the cliche of, you know, the hot flash. That was like the one symptom every doctor acknowledged. And so you also mentioned sugar consumption. And so can you talk about the connection between insulin and hot flashes or eat what you're putting into your body in terms of food and hot flashes and the relationship?
So there does seem to be a causal relationship. You know, women who have diets high in fiber, women who have diets low in added sugars, women who eat more Mediterranean-esque kind of diets or kind of like Galveston diet do tend to have less symptoms. The healthier you are going into your menopause, like how you show up in perimenopause will help guide the severity of your symptoms. That being said, women with perfect nutrition can have debilitating symptoms. I don't want to make it, it's not 100% correlation. And I don't want to make any women feel bad that like, wait, I'm eating healthy. I'm really suffering through menopause. But you tend to, you know, that can affect the severity. Certainly, you can have triggers. Some people have triggers with spicy foods can make the hot flashes worse, you know, things that'll cause vasodilation on their own. So what a hot flash is the thermoregulatory center in the brain gets dysregulated through the menopause. For some women, it's severe. And you have dilation of the blood vessels on the skin, usually in the central area, and that causes release of heat. And you just end up with this. I remember when I had hot flashes before I got treated, you know, it would just feel like this fluttering in my chest and then this heat would just start rising into my neck. And then I'd immediately start sweating in the back of my head and neck and then down my abdomen. It's just crazy.
Is there anything you recommend? Is there a hack, if you will, or a real-time tool to help someone when they're experiencing a hot flash?
Well, outside of, you know, stopping the estrogen deprivation with hormone therapy, there are some hacks, you know, putting a fan by the side of your bed, putting ice water at the side of your bed, you know, things to kind of rapidly treat the hot flashes once they come to kind of get them to quiet down sooner. My patients who, you know, are trying the chill pads, they're expensive, but they're pads you can put on top of the mattress that can, they run a cooling system through it. You know, I do have, even with menopause treatment, I'm still warmer than I used to be. My husband makes fun of me. I used to be freezing at night all the time. And now I have the thermometer leg that at least at 2 a.m, I tend to throw out of the bed without thinking about it. And he's like, you're doing it again, you know, to cool myself down. And then I get cold again and the leg goes back under the covers.
And so you mentioned hormone replacement therapy. What are some of the disadvantages and risks and advantages of that treatment?
So if you look at kind of the global effect of menopause, of estrogen deprivation, you know, of course, initially hormone therapy was developed to treat hot flashes, really, okay? And what they found anecdotally was that women who started hormone therapy early, like early in their menopause, you know, when the hot flashes started, tended to have less cardiovascular disease risk. You know, there's a lingering effect of estrogen that protects us from cardiovascular disease, keeps those vessels open longer, stop, you know, decreases the risk of plaques forming in those carotid vessels and the cardiac vessels. And so if you think of all the organ systems that are affected, and you look at, like, there's some studies coming out of Britain, Great Britain, published in the British Medical Journal, where they looked at exposure to estrogen, both natural and hormone therapy, and the risk of dementia. There was almost a direct correlation. The longer a woman had natural estrogen in her body plus HRT, the lower her risk of dementia was. And so when we talk about hormone therapy, you know, we recognize that it can go a long way in helping with the symptoms, the very obvious symptoms, the hot flashes, night sweats, sleep disruption. You get rid of those, you will sleep better. Things will get better in your life. You'll feel better. But what's happening in the back end that you're not immediately noticing, you're going to have stronger bones. You're going to have a less risk of cardiovascular disease. You're going to have less risk of mental health disorders. This is all proven. And you're going to have less risk of dementia, especially when you start early. But there is a window of opportunity for cardiovascular disease, because estrogen is better at prevention than cure. The longer you go without estrogen, the more likely those diseases are to get started. And estrogen is not great at undoing that damage once it's done, especially for neurodementia and cardiovascular disease.
So what's the sweet spot?
Really, as soon as possible. The WHI, they went and looked at the data and stratified it by age, and at least for the first 10 years. So your period stops. You have protection at least for those 10 years or until age 60. They kind of stop measuring after that. So it doesn't mean that a woman over 60 is not a candidate for hormone therapy. And that's kind of the misconception going around. We know that for the vast majority of women, probably 95% or more, the benefits will outweigh the risks at least until the age of 60 or the first 10 years of her menopause.
Wow. So it sounds like you kind of recommend it for everyone between 50 and 60.
Pretty much. I mean, well, depending on when she goes through menopause, if she's going through menopause at 45, I'm recommending it.
You know, it reminds me, so we've had Peter T on the show, and I think one of the big takeaways for everyone is, you know, cardiovascular disease and assessing risk. And he's of the view where, you know, similar in that I would call these, you know, pharmaceutical interventions to some degree. And he's of the view that lifestyle will only get you so far into minimizing cardiovascular risk. However, there are certain statins, and there are, I think, three or four he lists, and we'll put them in the show note, that can take your risk of heart disease, essentially, in his words, obliterate your ApoB to childlike levels, take it completely off the table.
Yeah, I'd love to see those studies done in women, because those were done in men.
But I think where I'm going is this sounds like the same thing. What I'm hearing from you is, look, you've mentioned all these great lifestyle modifications, you know, got to do resistance training, you need your protein, need your fiber, meditation, gratitude, you sleep, all these, you got to do it. However, you could be doing all these things right. And I think this is important because I also worry about, you know, shame culture, where you're doing all these things right, but you're still experiencing these debilitating symptoms. And this is, in my view, the beauty of the future of medicine, where you've got lifestyle modification, holistic based, science backed, and the best of pharma, if you will, coming together in a way that it is really powerful. And hormone replacement therapy sounds like this is one of those examples.
I absolutely agree. I mean, the more I dug into it, remember, in my training in medical school, I think I got maybe 1 hour lecture on menopause, and it was all about hot flashes.
Wow. An hour.
And in my OBGYN residency, there were no menopause clinics. There was no focused directed care on the menopausal patient. We maybe got 6 hours of lecture in 4 years. The vast majority of my training, which I'm super proud of, and I'm an excellent obstetrician, was on getting people pregnant, keeping them pregnant, protecting them once they'd had the baby, and then stopping them from getting pregnant. And then removing surgery, removing their uterus. You know, we had pediatric gynecology, we had oncology, we had reproductive endocrinology. These were all clinics and things that we had to do. Very important stuff for women's health. Menopause was like nothing. She has hot flashes. You know, we were just starting to learn more about the protected benefits of estrogen. I remember being in those, in those couple of lectures and like, oh, this is exciting. And then the Women's Health Initiative was announced. You know, all of those things that have now been rescinded, like hit the newsstands. We got multiple calls. I was the chief resident that year. And we were scared to death. of hormone therapy. And it's taken, that was 22 years ago. And it's taken that long for the pendulum to finally swing back, for the rescinded, you know, those, so many of the findings were rescinded, to finally get back into the mainstream and us to start talking about the benefits of hormone therapy with, you know, outside of just the cliche hot flashes, which are important.
So what are some of the questions someone should ask their doctor if they're interested in HRT to get a sense of, am I with the right practitioner or do I need to switch?
Unfortunately, if you look at the studies, your wonderful OB-GYN who delivered your babies and did great contraceptive management and did your hysterectomy and did all the things is probably not going to be your best bet for menopause care. Again, same thing. I was that doctor. I was not trained properly. I mean, the information put forth to us for our board certification every year, like I do all these exams every year to keep up my certification status, rarely has a menopause article. There's probably been two of significance in the last 4 years of the probably hundreds of articles I've had to read. So it's just not, you know, there's so much special interest in OB-GYN of all, you know, and the lion's share of the research funding goes to obstetrics, which is important. But it's kind of like, why is it that once my reproductive years are over, I'm no longer of scientific significance? My medical needs are not as important. And that all these studies for my cardiovascular disease, my lung disease, my kidney disease are all pretty much done on men. And my unique needs as a menopausal patient are not taken into account and not recognized. So what can, okay, so to answer your question, the Menopause Society is certifying providers. That's one decent place to start. Find a Menopause Society certified provider at menopause.org. You can go to their website and look up, you know, I'm one of them. That doesn't guarantee it, but it's definitely a place to start. My website, I have testimonials from hundreds and hundreds of followers who have said, hey, I had a great doctor. They gave me great care. And they've written testimonials and we've organized them by state and city. And you can find that on my website. Call and ask. Do you, you know, will you have a conversation with me about hormone therapy? You can't expect this to be a conversation during your 15-minute well woman exam when your legs are in stirrups. Like, that is not the right time. It really should be its own problem visit to talk about menopause care. But again, you know, you may probably, if you follow me on social media, you may know more than your doctor about modern menopausal medicine.
You're probably right about that. I'm laughing, but it's sad. You know, what are some of the other questions someone should ask while they're vetting their doctor?
You know, do you ever prescribe hormone therapy? Is that something you consider to be part of your practice? I'm not saying 100% of women will say yes, but every woman deserves a conversation as to her own needs, unique needs and risk and benefits. And so if that doctor doesn't feel competent to have that conversation, then it's time to look elsewhere. There are also, I forgot to add this, some really great telemedicine companies that have kind of come from this need where all they do is menopause care. And there's some great and some not so great. You know, I've kind of vetted a lot of them and I don't get paid by them, trust me. But, you know, I have a menopause empowerment guide on my website that lists, you know, I have like a spreadsheet listing different companies and pros and cons for each of them for so that a patient at least will have the option to consider one of those companies if they can't find care in person.
Got it. Well, we'll definitely link to that. To all of this in the show notes. And something else you're a big proponent of, which I love, is an annual midlife wellness visit. Could you talk more about that?
So, you know, the Well Woman exam as it stands has kind of devolved into a screening for breast and cervical cancer. You know, that's pretty much what the focus is. You're meant, you know, the American College of OB-GYN recommends you talk about 97 things and ask all these questions. But in reality, insurance company is paying for a 10-minute visit, in and out, you know, go get your blood work, get your mammogram, get your pap smear, and you're done. Scheduling what really should be the Well Woman exam, but, you know, the way insurance, you know, to work around the insurance, you really need to schedule a problem visit. I have a list of questions on my website to ask, you know, some tests to ask for outside of the normal CBC and complete blood count and metabolic panel that might be helpful based on your symptoms. So when a patient comes to me, I'm not doing a lot of hormone blood work. I can listen to a patient and determine her menopausal status more than likely. If I have any question, of course, I'll check hormone levels, but I'm doing a lot of blood work. I'm doing anemia panel, iron studies, looking at inflammation markers. I'm looking at nutritional labs, vitamin D, you know, homocysteine. I am doing the basics, the blood count and metabolic panel, you know, but I don't want to miss things that look like menopause that may be contributing to her symptoms. And of course, a full thyroid panel. 10% of women have hypothyroidism or more. So I don't want to miss that because quite often the symptoms can overlap.
Well, also too, something I'll emphasize, I'm a big believer in doing comprehensive blood work. You know, it's something you should just do once. If you do it once, you get that baseline and you understand like where are my deficiencies? Am I pretty good? And you don't have to, you know, do it quarterly, or sometimes you don't even need to do it annually if you're doing the comprehensive, although I do recommend, and I'm curious your take, like, you know, biannual, if you're very serious about your health, do some sort of biannual comprehensive testing, but you don't have to go bananas.
Right. For my patients, I'm pretty much, you know, doing yearly, but if things are abnormal, we're following those up quarterly, biannually, depending.
And what's your take on some of the new technology available, whether it's the full body scans or some of the microbiome testing or anything else, like some of the exciting new tech?
I'm curious, and it's pretty exciting. But, you know, again, my focus is the menopausal patient. And so how that applies to her, I'm avidly reading everything and making recommendations where I think. But for most of my patients, a lot of that stuff is out of their financial range.
Understood. So I'm curious, where do you want menopause care to go? What's the future? If you could wave your magic wand, and what would this look like?
Oh, gosh. You know, that menopause is its own specialty. It would basically be women's health and outside of just reproduction, like almost like OB-GYN residency would be women's health core. And then you kind of go off into doing obstetrics full time or gynecology surgery or menopause care. And that we really are jack of all trades. It's really not fair to the busy OB-GYN who's rushing to do surgery and deliver babies, because like in my menopause clinic, I'm kind of a cardiologist or ENT with, you know, tinnitus and vertigo. And first of all, I think we need comprehensive menopause education for all specialties. Anyone that touches a female patient needs to know this, you know, where menopause, the estrogen deprivation can affect that organ system. It's starting in medical school, you know, that we have this really comprehensive education around all specialties so that we can be better comprehensive providers and not just dump everything into OB-GYN because our ovaries quit, you know, and we have to live for 30 years without them, you know, and what that looks like.
That practice is very much focused on giving birth.
And birth is important for a lot of patients, but more women will go through menopause than give birth. When you look at, you know, female NIH funding for women's health, I think 0.3% goes to menopause. It's just ridiculous.
It's appalling. It's appalling. On that note, if you could conduct, let's say funding was possible for anything, if you could dream up a study, what would that be? What would you love to see get funded and happen?
Oh my gosh. So first of all, there's some pretty exciting studies going on right now, looking at medications and ways to extend the shelf life of the ovary, you know, so that we don't actually go through menopause. Now it's too late for me. My ovaries have given up and they're done. But, you know, for my daughters, I have a 23 and a 20-year-old daughter, and they're very interested in that kind of technology. Is there a way that we could prolong the life of the ovary, not so much to delay, you know, to have children into our later years, but more to just continue enough estrogen production so that we don't suffer from osteoporotic fractures and earlier heart disease and mental health disorders and Alzheimer's and dementia.
Wow. So what is that? Is that a pharmaceutical? What is that?
It's looking like it's big pharma. So Oviva is one of the companies, Daisy Robinson, PhD, like who I had the honor to sit next to at dinner one night. And my daughter was sandwiched between us. My daughter's in medical school now. And so she was like, mom, you got to meet this girl. You know, it's a busy dining table and I'm talking left and right. And she keeps leaning over like, you have to meet this woman. And I just got into a conversation with her and it was just phenomenal, the research that she was doing all about delaying menopause to keep women healthier. And then lots and lots of studies on perimenopause. There's almost nothing out there. Everything is observational, like really proactive studies looking at treatment of menopausal symptoms in perimenopause and what that's going to look like for her long-term health. Like how early should we start doing surveillance for perimenopause and begin supporting her with estrogen therapy.
And what's your view on how early we should be looking at it? Like, if I'm a 30-year-old woman right now, should I be having this conversation?
I think you should. I mean, I would love to create a CGM instead of a G, a CEM, a continuous estrogen monitor that could start detecting, you know, disruptions in the forest and how early, and then what supplementing those disruptions would look like, so that, you know, my daughter, my 23-year-old is like, Mom, why should menopause even be a thing for me? I'm going to know, I'm going to be monitoring, I'm going to be catching it early. I don't ever want it to be a blip on my radar. You know, I want to do just age without, I don't want to age without menopause. And I was like, huh.
So that's really fascinating. I'm guessing that's actually possible because it's tapping into your blood. Estrogen is blood. Like, it's, someone could do that tomorrow if they chose to do that. If a company chose to do a continuous estrogen monitor, that's within the realm.
Right. So like one-time blood tests say nothing in perimenopause because it is a zone of hormonal chaos. You know, it is this incredible roller coaster on the way down, but it is like massive ups and downs. Whereas, you know, EKG is what most healthy women's reproductive cycles look like, with estrogen, progesterone surges after that. But perimenopause is absolutely chaotic. And you get these massive rise and falls. And so knowing that that's starting to happen and being able to treat that, you know, and kind of suppress things a little bit and shore you up in those lows, I really think could go a really long way to not only decrease symptomatology, which is important, but make keep you healthier for longer, so that, you know, women live longer than men. We all know this, but 20% of our lives, not just the longer part, are in poorer health than their male counterparts. Why? It's menopause. It's menopause. It's frailty and dementia, both of which are preventable.
Well, we're fixing that with our resistance training and protein intake. And so coming back to, you know, the wild swings in estrogen, what's driving, is it a factor of what's happening in the day, lifestyle, stress, food? Like, what are the things that kind of drive that roller coaster in the day?
Definitely, you know, our endocrine system is very sensitive to those lifestyle changes. But what's happening on a biochemical level? We have the hypothalamus and the pituitary. The hypothalamus is constantly testing our blood, checking for estrogen levels constantly. Okay. Are they high? Are they low? Are they high? Are they low? What's going on? When they start dropping, it says, okay, pituitary. It sends out something called GnRH, gonadotropin releasing hormone. It pulsatiles, it starts pulsing to the pituitary. Pituitary starts producing luteinizing hormone and FSH, follicular stimulating hormone. These hormones then travel to the ovary and start stimulating our thecaludian cells to create this follicle around the germ cell, the egg, to get it to ovulate. And those cells around that ovulation start producing our testosterone, estrogen. Okay. After ovulation, progesterone is then produced inside what we call the corpus luteum, which is the cyst walls where the egg came out. That process gets disrupted because we're losing the ability of our thecaludian cells, because of age, to produce the hormones. So the brain's like, whoa, 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 whoa. It's not high enough. What's going on? We need more. So it starts getting more and more LH and FSH, and all of a sudden the ovary starts surging. Okay, so it's not unusual to, in perimenopause, to have a really high FSH level, almost at a menopausal range, and a really high estrogen level, because all of a sudden it like got a surge and we had this explosion of estrogen happen. And then the whole thing quiets down for a minute. That's called a loop cycle. And so happening usually in mid to late perimenopause. And so that's where we see kind of this hallmark. Certainly lifestyle, all of that kind of exacerbates that. But again, even with perfect nutrition and zero stress, these things happen in our perimenopause journey to full menopause.
Yes. So let's say you've got a billboard. It's on the freeway. On this billboard, you could put any short message. Maybe it's a mantra, maybe it's a quote. But this is your opportunity to spread your message. What would be on your billboard?
Menopause is inevitable, but suffering through it is not.
Beautiful. So now we've covered a lot of ground today. In addition, everyone pick up The New Menopause. I'll hold up the book for those watching on YouTube. Anything else you'd like to cover, or any words of wisdom you'd like to leave our audience with?
The book is about giving you a resource to educate yourself so that you can be a better informed provider. I think we're a generation of healthcare providers away from getting everyone up to speed on this. And so, you know, in this time between, you're going to have to be your own advocate and maybe get creative about searching out healthcare providers who are going to be able to help you. But they are there. They're getting more plentiful. I'm sorry, it is so dramatic, you know, but remember, you have power. You have power to advocate for yourself. You know, my website can give you research articles to show your doctor. You know, I try to give you as many tools as possible to be your own advocate so that you at least have a shot, you know, at traversing this very natural process as healthily as possible.
Amen. Mary Claire, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.